I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In.
Today's guest, Coleman Hughes, is a writer, podcaster, and musician focusing on race, public policy, and applied ethics. At the age of 28, he's already becoming a well-known commentator and critic on issues related to race-based policies. He was a fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research and a fellow and contributing editor at their City Journal. He's also the host of the podcast Conversations with Coleman. In 2019, he testified before a U.S. House Judiciary Subcommittee at a hearing on reparations for slavery, arguing against the campaign. In 2023, he delivered a talk at the annual TED Conference in Vancouver, Canada, advocating a societal goal of colorblindness, that is, treating people without regard to race, both personally and in public policy. Internal opposition from TED prevented the internet posting of this talk, which was eventually released after Hughes agreed to its being paired with a debate between him and New York Times columnist James Bowie. In addition to writing columns for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other publications, Hughes is the author of the recently published book, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America, which is the subject of today's interview. Coleman, welcome to Delving In.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, congratulations on your blossoming career as a writer, commentator, and public speaker.
Thanks very much.
I was happy to come across your work, which struck me as the kind of nuanced thinking about race that I was looking for, thoughtful and independent, not easily pigeonholed as fitting a party line. I omitted your racial and ethnic background in the bio I just read, in keeping with the goal of refraining from placing too much emphasis on these identifiers as a shortcut for evaluating a person's thinking and convictions. That said, let's hear about your background, given that it figures strongly into your motivation to write your recent book. And you do talk about it early in the book as well. So let's talk about that, and then we'll get more into the content.
Absolutely, yeah. So I grew up in Montclair, New Jersey, which is a nice suburb outside of New York City, very racially diverse. And I grew up not thinking of people in racial terms primarily. I had friends of every race, but I didn't think of them as belonging to a race. And I grew up essentially obeying the Martin Luther King ethic of judging people by the content of their character over the color of their skin. And then I got to about 16 years old. I went to a conference called the People of Color Conference, which was a gathering of students from around the nation, where I encountered a very different philosophy towards race. And it was a philosophy which, instead of downplaying the significance of racial identity, made racial identity central to who you are. They essentially considered blackness a kind of magic, or really any non-white racial identity a kind of magic inside of you. And it emphasized things like internalized oppression, systemic racism, white privilege, so on and so forth. And I noticed the difference between that way of talking about race and the way of talking about race I had grown up with, namely the kind of default MLK style liberalism of not judging people, not considering race to be important. And when I got to Columbia University in 2015, I noticed that the new philosophy of race, wherein race became sort of everything about somebody, was the dominant strain of thinking. And I began to notice how poisonous it was as a way of approaching other human beings and thinking about society in general. And that was my entry point into the topic of race.
So as I understand it, when you went to public school in Montclair, it was racially diverse and you really didn't have any reason to think about racial identity, your own racial identity, all that much, because it sounds like it wasn't a particularly racist place, that everybody was pretty well accepted. But then you got to an elite, I don't know if it was a private school or the Newark Academy, where you were very much in the minority. And it's almost as if you suddenly realized that you were Black, and that before that, being Black really didn't mean much.
I always knew I was Black, but that it...
As an identity, as something that was really important in some way. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It had no deep significance to me. And even at Newark Academy, I don't think it had any, it didn't have deep significance to me. Really what happened is that I had an afro. And at my public school in Montclair, everyone was used to seeing Afros because there were so many black kids in general. So even the white kids who might otherwise be tempted to touch an Afro see them so regularly that there's nothing really notable about having one, right? Nothing curiosity inducing about having one. Whereas when I went to the private school, a lot of these kids came from towns that were predominantly or entirely white or Asian, or certainly towns with no black kids really. So when they saw a black kid with an Afro, it's probably something they had only ever seen on TV or from afar, and they had this understandable curiosity to touch it. Unfortunately, the curiosity was just insatiable. It would just never end. It would be every day. And it's frustrating when you try to get your hair to look good for school, and then people are just constantly touching it all day and ruining it. And it got to the point where after months of this, I broke down to my parents in tears, not realizing how bothered I was by it. And by that, I couldn't get it to stop. And eventually I just got the hairstyle I have now. But basically at the time, I experienced that as an annoying, just an annoying part of my life, right? I didn't experience it as racism. I didn't frame it as racism. I framed it as kids who were unfamiliar with my hairstyle, my poofy hair, always wanting to touch my poofy hair, and me not being able to get them to stop, really. And the problem about it is that it wasn't bullying, right? It wasn't mean-spirited at all. These are kids I got along with in every other context. I was never a target of bullying in any way. So to really draw a hard boundary on people that were essentially benign was something I wasn't able to do. So cut to years later, when I'm at this People of Color conference, the way that they frame this experience is a microaggression, which is a word that was new to me and new to the culture at the time. This is 2012. According to them, what I had experienced was not an annoying, frustrating kind of social experience. It was much more than that. It was a microaggression, which put it on the same continuum as the kind of racist, the deep racism that someone like my grandfather would have experienced growing up. Put it on the same continuum in some way as lynching and slavery itself. But in other words, I was receiving a micro dose of what Black Americans have experienced in macro dose, namely racism.
Yeah. So in other words, it didn't have the negative valence for you that was assumed by the concept of microaggression. It was something akin to, let's say, a white person going to sub-Saharan Africa, were in a village where no one had ever seen a white person before, and all the kids want to touch that person's skin because, wow, what is that? Or seeing an exceptionally tall person who's 7'6". Most people walking by such a person would stare, even though they know they're not supposed to.
That's right. Or they would constantly ask, how's the weather up there? And you can understand how the guy might be annoying after 2 months, everyone asking, how's the weather up there, right? But no one is trying to be an asshole to you. It's just people can't contain their curiosity, especially kids. So that's how I experienced it. But then it was changed to this racism, put in the racism category by this new philosophy.
So what's interesting about identity is you have your inner identity and you have the identity as perceived by other people. And when it's in the latter, it can feel like an imposition, it seems to me, that other people see you as different and you don't feel different, or you didn't until later on. In other words, people have their own personal identity, let's say as Black or Jewish or Irish or whatever, and they're, let's say, proud of that identity, has content to it more than just that they're seen as different. But then you have the outer identity, how other people see you. And if a lot of other people are seeing you as somehow different from them, that can feel alienating after a while. So it's a kind of complexity in identity.
It's interesting, though, because in my memory, I don't remember experiencing that as being thought different in general. I experienced it as really just, they just can't get over this poofy hairstyle. They weren't treating me differently. These are kids I'm eating lunch with. I'm hanging out with them after school. I'm going to their house. I'm joking on the bus with them all the time. I'm all the normal things of friendship and acquaintanceship at that age. But they just also were constantly wanting to touch my hair.
So you experienced it as a kind of mild harassment, it sounds, but not a racially based harassment.
That's right. Mild, but then deeply annoying in the aggregate because there were so many people that wanted to do it once per day.
And how did those experiences and other experiences of your childhood figure into writing this book? It sounds like it was the Person of Color Conference that was really the catalyst more than anything else.
The Person of Color Conference was the first time I experienced what would later be called wokeness or social justice, or sometimes called CRT, which would become a big part of the of elite discourse maybe 5 years later. And it was really my Columbia experience where I was a Black student at Columbia for 4 years. And we're talking about one of the least racist environments on planet Earth, in the sense that, you know, Columbia is full with of liberal, progressive people that are not just weakly committed to being non-racist towards Black people and Hispanic people, but are deeply committed to not being perceived in any way, shape, or form as an ignorant white person or as insensitive to issues of racism, right? Highly progressive. Yet, I would read in the campus newspaper every day just the most absolutely hyperbolic and hysterical claims about how much white supremacy there was on campus, which was very strange to me because I thought white supremacy was the thing that my grandfather was up against, really, and certainly not the thing I was up against on my highly ultra-liberal college campus. So the fact that on the one hand, I was in this extremely non-racist environment, and on the other hand, I could open the campus newspaper on any given day and find shrieking about racism, that mismatch made me curious. I was like, what is going on that the perception so many seem to have is so out of step with what seems to be my reality here?
So you were, in a way, being encouraged to feel oppressed, but you didn't feel oppressed.
That's right.
Let's move on to talking about race. You spend a fair number of pages early in the book talking about what is race. And I love your expression that it's not science, where science carves nature at its joints, which I love that expression, that a race is something that's socially constructed, arbitrary, fraught with politics, a very inaccurate proxy for identifying disadvantage. Could you say a little bit more about that, about, you know, what the concept of race is as you understand it?
Yeah, I have a longer discussion of this in my book, but I'll try to give a somewhat shorter version here. Basically, there's been a debate, a longstanding debate, over whether race is a natural fact or a social construct. My view is that it's basically in between. It is a social construct in the sense that there is no sharp line, no scientific sharp line to be found between what we call races. We are one human race. On the other hand, what population geneticists study is the fact that when some 50,000 years ago, the thinking now, or at least was when I was writing the book, various people began to migrate out of Africa and were isolated for long enough that some, the ones in Europe, developed light skin and particular features, and the ones in Asia developed particular features, and people ended up isolated, populations ended up isolated for long amounts of time and long enough to evolve divergently in the ways that make us look different today. And the legacy of those out of Africa migrations is still visible. And there is clustering to be found in the data, right? It's not that everyone is randomly different from everyone else. There's actually clustering if you're a descendant of certain populations. Now, on the other hand, there is no line between these to be drawn, no hard and fast line to be found in the scientific data, and no clustering strong enough where you can just bucket people reliably without massive bleeding over of all of these categories. So the fact that we draw those sharp lines on the census, that is a social construct. And even the way that we draw those lines, the fact that you're Caucasian if you're from Afghanistan, but if you're 2 miles over the border to Pakistan, then you're Asian, that's totally arbitrary. And yet, these arbitrary categories are ones that we base social policy on. It can matter to your small business whether you are technically Hispanic or not. The definition of Hispanic just makes absolutely no sense, has no relation to science, no relation to history, and is essentially arbitrary. And even if it weren't arbitrary with respect to population science, I would argue it's still arbitrary with respect to social disadvantage. So my argument in the book is that, yes, we ought to address disparities of luck in society and the fact that some people are born more advantaged than others. The government has a role to play in ameliorating that, but it should do that on the basis of class and socioeconomics rather than on the basis of race, because race is not as good a proxy for disadvantage as someone's class or socioeconomic status is.
Yeah, if we could just back up a second a little bit more about race, and that's one is that there's a really arbitrariness about how the race categories get carved up. So for instance, Asian encompasses so many different groups that it's almost silly to lump them all together. And the other point, which I don't know if it's in your book, is that there's far more variance in any category or quality within a race than between races. I tend to overestimate the differences between the races when the differences are far greater within each race. And then the third thing is that skin color is a very poor proxy because, you know, you have South Indians who are as dark as Sub-Saharan Africans, and they're obviously a very different genetic stock, even though they may look the same color.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, then there's the term systemic racism, which is also a kind of a vague term. It's really hard to wrap one's mind around what it exactly means. I think it doesn't mean just one thing. What counts as the system? Is it laws? Is it tax codes? Is it under-the-radar hiring practices? Is it the location of retail stores? Is it commuter rail stations? Is it that there are culturally normative ways of thinking and speaking? What is systemic racism? And it's in order to have a discussion about it, you need to have an idea of what it is, and yet what it is probably multifactorial and not agreed upon between different speakers.
Yeah, so the idea of systemic racism was originally called institutional racism, and I believe it came originally from the 1967 book Black Power by Stokely Carmichael. And what they had in mind at the time was essentially just any racism that is not outright violence, right? So they distinguish between KKK style racism, just lynching somebody, beating somebody up, and more subtle kinds of racism, such as a real estate agent putting up roadblocks to you buying a house because you're black and they don't want someone black in the neighborhood. So that's what was originally meant by systemic racism, but what it's morphed into is the idea that any disparity between black Americans and white Americans in general must be the result of a kind of amorphous, unseen racism, rather than the fact that multicultural societies always have disparities between groups. Groups have different demographics, different cultures, different specialties, different not very non-random patterns of specialization and all kinds of, for all kinds of reasons, which is why you don't even see parity between different white ethnic groups or different black ethnic groups of the same race. That's what it's become now. It's become a sort of catch-all explanation for why black people are 13% of the population, but not 13% of every domain of value and concern.
So that would be a kind of attribution of systemic racism based on outcomes, is what you're talking about, I think.
Yeah.
So let's talk just a little bit about an experiment by Michael Bernstein. He used a quote, and I'll quote it for you from your book. "Black supremacy is as dangerous as white supremacy, and God is not interested merely in the freedom of black men and brown men and yellow men. God is interested in the freedom of the whole human race." And then Bernstein asked people to rate that quote on a scale from 1 to 5, where 5 is the most biased or racist. The experiment was that the quote was attributed to either Martin Luther King or Donald Trump. And depending on who the reader of this quote thought had said the quote, they would mark it as either extremely racist or not. And so it really speaks to the implicit bias that people have in how people categorize what they hear based on who they think they heard it from.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting experiment for a couple reasons. One, it's just under the heading of sort of cognitive biases people have, where two different people could say the exact same thing, and it could read as either a statement of frank racism or a statement of anti-racism, depending on how people judge the underlying speaker. It also, however, demonstrates, this is certainly one of the lesser known King quotes, although he said it more than once in his career. And it speaks to the philosophy underlying the civil rights movement, which was that racism can go in any direction in principle. Whites can be racist, blacks can be racist, whites can suffer racism, blacks can suffer racism, Hispanics can perpetrate and suffer racism, on and on down the list. Racism was viewed by the civil rights leaders in principle as an omnidirectional phenomenon. However, the racism that was most present at the time that they were fighting was anti-black racism. There's a starting with the Black Power movement and CRT scholars in the 70s and 80s, and it's now actually popular today. There's a different definition of racism, which says that it's racism equals prejudice plus power, and black people don't have power, therefore black people can't be racist, nor can white people suffer reverse racism, since they do have power.
So it's a kind of an exaggeration of the truth, which is, I think there certainly is much more racism from white to black than the other way around, but there is some in the other direction.
That would be, the amount of racism directed at anyone would be a separate point from whether it counts as racism.
Exactly. But it seems that there might be a bias toward discounting black and white racism because it doesn't amount to, as the effects are not nearly as bad in the aggregate.
Because the effects aren't nearly as bad in the aggregate on the white community. Yeah, I think there's an underdog bias that people have where someone who is viewed as having less power, you care more about their experiences. But I would also wonder why that isn't applied at the individual level. For example, whenever a sort of famous or powerful black person is alleged to have experienced racism, like Claudine Gay, the former president of Harvard, the level of sympathy that comes out with her is unbounded by people who care strongly about racism, even though this woman's president of Harvard and has probably a high six-figure salary and so on and so forth, and is by no means the downtrodden of society. So I would wonder why it's only applied at the group level as opposed to the individual level.
Yeah, I think we're talking about a kind of identity politics where people make the decisions based on which group they're part of. And I think about the O.J. Simpson trial, which I don't know if that was before your time or you were little when that happened.
Yeah, it was just before I was born, I think.
Yeah, that there were huge differences between how the black people saw that trial and white people. And this is, of course, a highly privileged person from most points of view. And this is a super successful person, a very wealthy person who could afford the very best lawyers and to good effect in his criminal trial. But there was an assumption, I think, by African-Americans that there was going to be bias against him because he was black, even though he was so successful.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think it's fair to say OJ was very likely guilty. And whether, I still don't know, was it the case that really that percentage of black people thought he was innocent, or that many in the black community who would answer that he was innocent on a poll privately knew or suspected he was guilty, but as a result of the, especially LAPD at the time, was notoriously abusive, there was a sense that they've gotten away with so much over the years that if this is an opportunity to get back at them, then so be it. I think that was an attitude. I'm not saying it's a justifiable attitude. I don't think it is. But I'm not sure actually that black Americans all thought OJ was innocent.
Yeah, it's hard to know, isn't it? I think one of the things your book gets at is the divisiveness of identity politics. Tribalism, us versus them, the oppressor-oppressed dynamic, the kind of simplified version of reality. And I think you're also decrying a kind of a victim mentality that can set in if you identify too strongly with the oppressed group or the group as oppressed, which isn't to say that the oppressed group is not oppressed. It may, in fact, be oppressed, but do you want that to be the cornerstone of your identity?
Yeah, I would argue if in fact it were the case that black people were oppressed at this time, I would have no problem front loading that fact insofar as it was a fact. And I think it would be perfectly appropriate when slavery was legal, and to a lesser degree, when Jim Crow was the law of half the land. But we've reached a point where there isn't a position of power in America, from CEO of Fortune 500 companies to Supreme Court justices to president, that Black people haven't or can't occupy. We've seen a precipitous decline in every indicator of racism over the past 50 years. And it's not the case any longer that we are oppressed. And yet I do think that there is a strong urge to cling to the narrative that we are as a kind of holding pattern that can certainly blind people to reality.
What about remaining sources of disadvantage? From what you just said, you think that we've arrived at a kind of equality when I think it's pretty clear that's not 100% true. So just by way of example, there was a book just came out by Jonathan Kozol at the age of 87 about the continuing inequality in schools that are predominantly Black or Hispanic, that the conditions of these schools on aggregate are far worse than average. There's far more lead in the paint and the pipes, and the conditions are really poor, and the funding is really poor because a lot of places fund their schools by property taxes, which is not the case, fortunately, in New Mexico. It's state taxes, so they're much more equal. But in a lot of places, it's funded by property taxes, and people will move to towns or cities that have better funding for their schools, for instance. So there's a kind of legacy effect, if you will, that affects minority communities more than predominantly white communities. And it seems like there's still some work to be done to equalize things.
I'm not a school funding expert, but doesn't the federal government makes up the difference, right?
Only to a very small extent. Most school systems are funded by property taxes. That's why, for instance, in Boston, the best schools are in Brookline and Newton. Those are the wealthiest.
We don't have to go get sidetracked by this. But I've definitely seen studies of whole states or whole districts where the minority schools have more funding than the non-minority schools. And in some cases, it's not throwing money at the issue seems like a misdirection of a lack of pinpointing the problem. For example, I cite a study in my book by Roland Fryer, who is a Harvard economist, and he was able to, which is unprecedented given the power of teachers' unions, he was able to get a set of something like 20 schools in Houston, 20 public schools, randomly pick half of them and do whatever he wanted with them. Fired the principals, fired half the teachers, replaced them with better people, and instituted a kind of charter school model that he had studied from New York City charter schools, where he extended the school day. He might have even extended the length of the school year. People can read the last chapter of my book for details. He instituted what he called a culture of high expectations, a kind of stricter tough love approach to schooling, more frequent testing, more frequent feedback on those tests, and was able to raise scores by an impressive amount, math and English scores, and I think raised them most amongst the most low-income kids. And the bottleneck to doing something like that is much more, I think, teacher unions than funding. Teachers unions and all of the political machinations and roadblocks required to make those kinds of changes.
Yeah, I think it's not only funding, but certainly funding would have something to do with it, particularly if you have a longer school day and a longer school year. And in order to implement a new program, that requires money as well. It's not necessarily massive amounts of money, but certainly requires attention. If in addition to money, there needs to be a recognition that there's a problem and in a targeting of particular schools for kind of an enhanced model of education. Eventually, you'd want all schools to have such enhancements, I would think. You start out with the least privileged. And certainly school buildings would be a huge part of it. I've heard of schools where there was such a lack of funding that some of the classrooms had to be in the bathroom. just so underfunded. Let's move on, though. I wanted to talk more about what you mentioned about outcomes as not being a reliable indicator of racism. And you talk about differences between ethnic groups, including ethnic groups within the white category and also ethnic groups within the Black category. You have African Americans versus Caribbean Americans, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is actually a longstanding finding. I think Thomas Sowell published a scholarly article about this in the 70s, where you have rather wide disparities in some cases between Black Caribbeans and Black Americans, Black Caribbeans from places like Jamaica and so forth. There was one study, I think that I quote it in the book, by a Columbia sociologist named Van Tran, who studied Black Caribbeans in New York compared to Black Americans in New York and found that they had very different cultural attitudes towards parents, different cultural attitudes towards drug use, all kinds of different value-based behavior, and also had somewhat different outcomes. And it's not to say correlation is causation, but the presence of large disparities between different ethnic groups of the same race, where you have Black Nigerians earning much more money than Black Haitians, you have Chinese Americans earning far more money than Hmong Americans, something like 60 cents on the dollar is that disparity. You have Indian Americans, who are the highest earning ethnic group, earning much more than Pakistani and Bengali Americans. And this is actually the norm rather than the exception. It cuts through this kind of false belief that in a world with no discrimination, we should expect to see equal outcomes across the board. It's a contradiction to say that on the one hand, we do and want to live in a multicultural society where people bring different things to the table, have different values, and we celebrate those important differences. Yet we expect everyone to achieve identically across the board and in the same domains. I also cite something in the book where something crazy like 2/3 of the donut shops in California were owned only by Cambodians, which is a massive disparity in the domain of the donut profession. But that's actually not unusual when you're studying multicultural societies for different cultural groups to specialize in different skill sets. So this has been Thomas Sowell's whole career trying to make this point, and I conveyed a little bit of that in the book.
Yeah, so one thing I just want to mention is that I think you can't assume that, let's say, the average Nigerian-American is the average Nigerian, because who's coming from Nigeria? The people that are highly educated, a lot of doctors, for instance, who can't find enough opportunity within Nigeria because there's a kind of a surplus of highly educated, and so they're coming here and other places. So that's very different than, let's say, the people fleeing from a particular country or not from an educational elite, but are from, let's say, the least advantaged. Then you at least for a generation or two, you wouldn't necessarily see a high level of achievement from that group, as opposed to a group that's coming already with educational advantages.
Absolutely. That's part of my point. Namely, it's the non-discrimination variables. The variables which aren't racial discrimination are that make up the majority of the reason why certain groups do so well and others don't, and yet can account for seeing some groups at the very top of the income spectrum and others at the very bottom. And that can be, there's a million reasons for that, and many of them are the ones you just cited. Is a group a refugee group, or is a group the most upwardly mobile and striving ones that were able to get a visa, right? So all of these things correlate with human capital variables that account for outcomes, even though both groups are the same race. And therefore, you wouldn't expect to see a big difference in racial discrimination directed at one or the other.
And then you have cultural differences about the value of education. And I think it's no coincidence that ethnic groups that have been valuing education and literacy for thousands of years are going to do better than cultures that don't value literacy so much. How many books you have in the house? You wouldn't expect a family that, say, emphasizes reading from less than a year old to not have an advantage when it comes to school attainment in general. Even with totally equalizing the schools, you still would see some differences, I would think.
It almost goes without saying, but it's very important. And you have a culture like China, which has actually had a standardized test for the whole country for about 1,000 years with very few interruptions. I think there was the civil service test, famously. So you have a culture where it has been normal to work towards an extremely important standardized test that almost anyone in the country is allowed to take for 1,000 years. And then you port people from that culture over to a culture now where we do the SAT, ACT, and we have this incredibly important test. And obviously, it would stand to reason that you can fall into a study culture that's extremely helpful. And by dint of good luck, essentially, cultural and historical good luck geared towards falls rather well into that task where you have cultures, people from other cultures, where the only book that anyone has in their house is a holy book and nobody even reads it, really. To talk about the advantages one can have just from one's family's historical background are immense.
Let's talk a bit about affirmative action, because clearly you're not very comfortable with the idea of affirmative action, particularly at the stage where people are being selected for a job. I think you're more comfortable with it, I think, if it's done extremely early, like the early elementary school up until high school, I would think, at least. That early intervention, Head Start, making sure that there's adequate prenatal health care, this kind of thing. My understanding is that you would want this targeted not necessarily along racial lines, but along income or economic disadvantage lines.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, like I said, class and socioeconomics at this point is a much better proxy for race. I, as a Black and Hispanic kid that grew up upper middle class, I don't need... I'm not who we're talking about when we talk about the disadvantaged or those born with less, those who aren't privileged. And so any algorithm which selects me into a bucket for people that need preferential treatment, I would argue can be improved upon. And the algorithm I recommend is something that takes income, wealth into account. It could even take in other circumstances, like what was the crime rate in your census tract. You can get as sophisticated with you as you want with these kinds of measures. But I think if the purpose of an affirmative action style policy is to lift up the disadvantaged, then we should target the disadvantaged. We should not assume that race is a proxy for disadvantage at this point anymore.
Yeah, you allow one exception, at least, and that's with policing. That in your book, you argue that there is one profession where it really would be an advantage to have racial and ethnic diversity in order for the police department to have credibility and trust by the population. There, you might actually even have a quota, I would think.
Yeah, I think that my principle of colorblindness is not absolute. I view it more as a default than an absolute. I argue it should be the default presumption that colorblindness rules the day. But if there are really compelling reasons why you have to take color into account, for example, what if it were the case that in a city, and this may have been the case in the 70s in certain cities, where you have a Black population that is overrepresented in terms of crime, but you have a police force that's almost all white? That's highly suboptimal because the Black community is very likely to see the cops as simply a kind of colonial entity. And it's a terrible basis for trust. And it actually makes it harder for the cops to do their jobs and keep the community safe. So it's a net loss on both sides. Would it make sense in that context to say, well, I don't think we have enough Black cops in the pipeline to clear our standards right now? Really, ideally, what you would want to do is aggressively recruit and train Black cops so that they meet the standards you already have. But in the absence of that, I think that's a situation where you might violate the rule to some degree and say, okay, we need to, at least on a temporary basis, hire Black cops under a different set of standards because we're unable to do our jobs effectively. I would argue most jobs in society, most jobs that we have are not like that. They don't fall into the category where you can't do them effectively if your firm essentially isn't racially diverse. Most jobs, as I say, are more like firefighting than policing, where you just really need the best person for the job.
Let's talk just a little bit more about affirmative action. It does seem to me that there's a kind of, I don't know if it's because of group identity, but a feeling that if your group is not represented in a profession, you're less likely to enter it because you might think subliminally or less subliminally that my kind is not really welcome in that profession. And that's not just racial, that's also gender. For instance, one time all doctors were male, or almost all doctors were male, or lawyers, or what have you, chess players. And when there's enough of the minority group becomes represented, then suddenly it's the minority group feels welcomed. So just an example of chess, after Queen's Gambit came out, suddenly there was a surge of interest by girls to play chess. I'm wondering, does that make sense to have some affirmative action in order to at least kickstart, if you will, the idea that profession welcomes all?
So I think I agree with the effect. I do agree that having that first person can be a bat signal to the community that we are welcome here, that we can, having the Jackie Robinson of any given domain does send a bat signal to the community that we can do this. And if we're good enough, we'll be accepted. And this kind of, this is something for us as well. Is affirmative action necessary to get that first person through the door in those scenarios? In practice, I think we've seen that you have, you can almost always, someone emerges who meets the standards or far exceeds them. And it should be noted, Judit Polgár, a woman from Hungary, chess player, had been top 10 in the world how many years ago? She's like the real life Beth Harmon. She's beat Magnus Carlsen in games, though it's not, I guess she's not really a superstar. She's not super in front of the cameras. And affirmative action wouldn't have been required, even in the case of chess, to show that you can be a top 10 player in the world and be a woman.
Yeah, it seems that it would be definitely preferable to have affirmative action in the recruitment stage rather than the selection stage. Because as you say, if you have it in the selection stage, then there's going to be doubt as to whether that person really has as good a credential or as good an ability as everyone else. And that could be corrosive in terms of the perception of that person in the job that they eventually obtain.
Yeah, that's right. And I agree with that. I say that in the book, that if, insofar as you're recruiting for a job or for some opportunity, and you're just going out to the networks of the people already there, then you can replicate the non-random sample of the people already there. I know the people I know that aren't a random sample of Americans or New Yorkers. I know my friends and family that are probably heavily skewed towards the institutions that I already know about, Columbia and so on and so forth. So yeah, it makes perfect sense to cast a wider net, and to specifically cast a wider net among the populations that you're looking to get more representation from. But once you get that, I think you ought to, in the vast majority of cases, judge on colorblind meritocratic standard, or else you will get the forever sneaking suspicion, merited or not, that people weren't qualified, or were that the people you hired for the job weren't the best for the job.
And one of your solutions is that you mentioned is blind assessments, which are used in the music world, for instance. For when someone applies to join a symphony, they play behind a screen. And that's because sometime in the past, there was a woman trombonist who was rejected because her playing wasn't masculine enough.
Is that true? I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah. But behind the screen, suddenly her playing was quite virile.
No, that's so funny.
And she was selected after that. And so after that became a kind of a norm. And as you say, that could become a norm for professors grading papers, as you had a professor at Columbia do, that don't look at the name until after you give the grade.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it strikes you as such an obvious improvement that the moment you encounter it, you're like, why doesn't everyone do this? If I talk to my grandmother, who grew up in segregated D.C., and I told her I got a bad grade from a professor or something, the first question she would ask is, was it a white professor? Because based on her life experience and based on the level of racism she grew up with, would not discount that the white teacher was picking on a black student because they were black. And I'm sure there have been many such cases throughout American history. Insofar as what you're concerned about is really like that kind of racism, like good old-fashioned racism, and it can be implicit too, it can be unconscious, why would you not want a blinding procedure? something that actually blinds the teacher to the data of the person's race that they're grading. Now, I argue it's a rather large omission on the part of the modern anti-racist movement that I critique as actually being neo-racist, that you almost hear almost nothing and sometimes opposition to blinding procedures like this. You saw an op-ed in the New York Times saying that actually we should get rid of those orchestra blind auditions because there aren't enough Black instrumentalists. Now, I argue, I'm a professional trombone player myself, mostly in the jazz world, but I've also played classical. Part of the reason there may not be 13% of orchestras filled with Black musicians is because the Black musicians grow up with culturally non-European classical styles of music to a higher degree. And so the most talented disproportionately gravitate towards other genres. That's a very plausible explanation for why you might not have 13% of oboe players in top philharmonics aren't Black. And it's no reason to get rid of the screen, which has almost certainly been beneficial to women and arguably may have been beneficial to minorities as well. And at the very least, we can be sure ensures a kind of level playing field at auditions. Another example would be traffic light cameras and red light cameras, where these can issue you a ticket for speeding or for running a red without involving a police officer. Doesn't have to pull you over, doesn't have to knock on the window, and now doesn't have to worry that the wallet that you're reaching for is a gun. So many kinds of terrible situations can be prevented by having the robots do this for us. But what you saw in the case of Chicago was activists actually disliked this system because it didn't yield equal ticketing rates by race. Even though the cameras were placed equally in different parts of the community, there are various reasons proposed for this. It could be, I'm not even going to speculate on what the reasons were. There are many reasons. But the crucial thing is that it was not officer bias and that officers were taken out of the system, and that this is a almost certainly a good thing.
That's an example not a good example of systemic racism. It was a system deliberately designed to be neutral.
It was a system deliberately designed to be color neutral. And the mere fact of different, of non-identical outcomes, non-census outcomes, is not sufficient reason to dismantle the system.
We don't have too much time left. I'd like to talk a little bit about reparation for slavery, which you've come out against. And I think one of the reasons is that you don't think that inherited trauma is real, that you talk about it as being a myth. But tell me, why are you against that idea? It seems that of reparations for slavery, that one would think that that would be the ultimate kind of admission of remorse by the society at large, and that once that's done, then you could say, look, we've at least owned up to it. Similar to Germany giving reparations for the Holocaust to Israel, and Israel and Germany now have excellent relations and have for quite some time. So why would you be against reparations? And actually, before you start, I just wanted to say one last thing about that. And that's that reparations would be given to anyone with a history, a personal history of having been descended from slaves, regardless of how well off they are now. Similar to how, you know, let's say paintings that were looted of Jews during the Holocaust, those descendants are entitled to compensation regardless of how successful they are because it was stolen.
Yeah, so I think to make the analogy work, you would have to add 150 years between the Holocaust and the reparations. I don't think there is precedent, or certainly not repeated or normalized precedent for paying reparations to. So, for example, I'm a descendant of slaves. To pay it to me, you'd have to establish that I'm owed it, even though my sixth great's grandfather was the slave. I don't think that it's not obvious to me that is owed, or that there's a precedent for that. And I've always been in favor of reparations or compensation paid to living victims of racist Jim Crow laws, such as they do in Evanston, where if you can show that you were denied a mortgage loan under in a red line neighborhood in the 50s or 60s, then you can get compensated. That I've always been in favor of. The idea that reparations for slavery at this point would be received as a kind of a deep gesture that would elicit kind of closure and seriousness about the issue, I think is false. I think the reason I think that is because every serious gesture that has been done up to this point has not been received in good faith by the sort of spokespeople and intellectuals in the Black community. It's actually been downplayed, memory holed, dismissed, and forgotten. For example, the Senate formally apologized for lynching in 2004. It's never mentioned as important or significant. Both houses of Congress formally apologized for slavery and Jim Crow in 2008 and 2009, which never gets acknowledged as significant. Something like 10 or more different states, because slavery was obviously a state issue, have formally apologized for slavery, never acknowledged as significant. We have a magnificent Smithsonian Museum in the capital of the country with an extensive exhibit on slavery in the Middle Passage. Two of our 11 national holidays are dedicated to different aspects of the Black freedom struggle, one to Martin Luther King, the great martyr of the movement, and one to Juneteenth, the day when slaves in Texas found that they were free. All of this, if you talk to anyone who's concerned about America's recognition of slavery, all of these things are viewed as just small beans in retrospect. And even though they almost all of them were demanded at the time as significant steps, in retrospect, they're dismissed as small beans, which describes a dynamic that I think is fundamental to the reparations movement, which is to say, if we did reparations on a Tuesday, on a Wednesday, you would see every newspaper, every major liberal newspaper in the country saying, don't think that's the end of the issue. We're gonna come again because that wasn't big enough. And that's what the conversation would be.
Back in the 60s, Martin Luther King said that African Americans had come a long way in terms of securing better rights, but had a long way to go. That he rejected both ideas, both the idea that there was no progress and also the idea that enough progress. So he rejected both of those, that a lot of work still needed to be done, even while recognizing the progress had been made. And I would think that if he were alive today, he would say the same thing. He would say, yeah, we've come even further, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, I'm sure that he would say that. I also, on the other hand, I would say, can you ever say the job is done? I don't think there's ever a point in a human society where we have poverty, we have violence, we have all these issues. There never is a point, I think, even in principle, where you can really rest easy because some of the problems are inherent to human nature. Each generation, we're going to be confronted with some people that are bigots or that grow up to be bigots. And we're going to have to figure out each generation how to deal with them.
So even though, let's say there's been progress in terms of the percentage of Americans who believe in colored blindness, let's say, you have a small group that have been empowered, it seems to me, and are very dangerous of white supremacists, for instance, that even though they may not have grown at all since Trump was first elected, there's a kind of emboldening process, not just by him, but also by social media. So this, I think you're right. Vigilance is really important, and we can't just say it's more or less done and we can start paying attention to other things. I think racism is still alive and well. And just example from the South, it's still standard practice in history books in the South to attribute the cause of the Civil War as being states' rights, not slavery. And things like that, it's not a full recognition yet.
Yeah, that's definitely a historical inaccuracy that should have been corrected long ago. I think in general, the white supremacy movement is as close to defeated as a movement can get in a country with free speech and 350 million people. You can't actually destroy movements in their entirety as long as the people who believe the crazy stuff can speak freely. if you want to compare the number of white supremacists to the number of like flat earthers or UFO people or...
Yeah, in terms of numbers, I think you're right. Yeah, anyway, I think we're almost out of time. I was wondering if either you or I could read from the very, very end of your book, just to encapsulate things.
You can read it. I don't have it in front of me, actually.
The neo-racist road leads to a grim world in which whites and minorities eternally swap the roles of the oppressor and the oppressed, the guilty and the blameless. A world with no conception of the common good, but one where individuals put the interests of their own racial group first, whatever the costs to others. The neo-racist pursuit of false equity results in a war of all against all. Instead of realizing the dream of true racial equality, we'll realize a nightmare of endless racial strife. The alternative is the dream I described earlier, a nation where people live in safety and enjoy the freedom to pursue their own happiness, a nation without second-class citizens, where the spirit of democracy prevails and politicians are held accountable to the people they serve, a nation that provides every child with a challenging education that develops the skills they need to grow into responsible adults, a nation where economic growth is steady, recessions are rare, and jobs are plentiful, a nation that provides quality health care to all its citizens and that invests heavily in caring for those who can't care for themselves, a nation where people are free to move from place to place and can afford to buy or rent homes in areas they want to live, a nation where people can enjoy their neighborhood without fear of crime and violence, a nation that leads the world in technological innovation, but ensures that technology serves people and not vice versa. A nation where people have many different beliefs but maintain a shared commitment to resolve disagreements with speech, not violence, and where people are free to engage in honest, open discussion without fear of being ostracized or canceled. A nation where wise management of difficult trade-offs on issues like immigration, national security, and wealth inequality sets an example for the rest of the world. A nation in which children hear their grandparents' stories about the old days and marvel at the promise we've made. That's a beautiful ending to your book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on to Delving In. Coleman Hughes, a writer, podcaster, and musician focusing on race, public policy, and applied ethics, and the author of the recently published book, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.